Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Reconstruction, brought to you by The Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of The Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined by my colleague Phil Bishop, who edits our daily online news service. Hello, Phil.
Morning, David. All good?
Yes, everything's fine. How are you?
I'm well, but you've just come back from holiday, I gather. This is a bit of a risky move.
Well, I wouldn't call it a holiday. a long weekend in very wet Cornwall, actually. I could have stayed here and had a long weekend in very wet Devon, but we decided to do it in Cornwall. Change is as good as a rest, as they say.
But you didn't have to go into hibernation moving back from Cornwall into Somerset.
No, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. No, we just, in fact, we left early because the weather was so bad and came home and it was like we'd never left, actually. So there we are. Have you been away at all, or have you got plans to go away this summer?
No. We were supposed to be. We were all set for a trip to Italy when lockdown looked like it was going to happen. So that went by the board, and we've not got round to, or not thought about booking anything since. We'll just wait and see and let it all settle down.
Yeah, that's probably wise, because I mean, if you did go away, you never know if you might be confined to quarters for a fortnight or more when you come back.
Yes, but for the likes of you and I, that's easy enough because we work from home anyway.
That's true. That is true. So we've got some news to talk about this week. Luckily, none of it to do with viruses or pandemics or anything like that. We've got some old topics to disinter and discuss again. Things which maybe listeners might have forgotten completely about, like, for example, Brexit. Remember that?
Brexit. Blimey. June 2016. Brexit, yeah. Britain voted to leave the European Union. And July 2020, here we still are in it, arguing about how and wherefore and whys.
It's quite remarkable, actually. I mean, nothing. It's as if we inadvertently forgot to worry about Brexit while this pandemic blew up. And all of a sudden, it's come back to bite us, because not much has happened, has it? There's still loads of imponderables and unanswered questions.
Well, the only good thing about COVID-19 and all of this business is that it has knocked Brexit off the news agenda for 6 months or so. And we've not been bored stupid by endless newspaper columns on what we should and shouldn't be doing.
We're here to change that.
Exactly. We're here to bore you folks. Well, we're trying not to. The reason why it's back on the construction industry's agenda is a letter from Andy Mitchell, who's the boss of Thames Tideway, the London super sewer project, who in his spare time, if he has any, is also the industry side chair of the Construction Leadership Council. Construction Leadership Council is a panel of people handpicked by government to advise it on what the industry, to be a liaison panel between the construction industry and the government, really. And he's one of the chairs, and some junior business minister is the other chair of this organisation. And Andy Mitchell has written to the Secretary of State for Business, Alok Sharma, heading his letter, preparing for a possible no deal with the European Union. And we had huge chunks of the letter in full on the Construction Index news pages. 21st of July was when he wrote this letter, so it'd be on our news pages morning of 22nd of July. He makes some good points that people have sort of pushed to one side. What did you think of it, David?
Well, I think, first of all, some of our listeners, not just our listeners, but people in general might be surprised that this spectre of a no-deal Brexit looming come the 1st of January 2021, when almost exactly the same concern was exercising everybody this time last year, when we were worried about having a no-deal Brexit on January the 1st, 2020. And somehow we managed to avert that. We concluded one part of the process of extricating ourselves from the European Union without a no deal. But of course, we're still in and we're not out yet. And we might leave without a deal. It's very confusing. I mean, have we got a deal? Haven't we got a deal? And what's the danger of having a no deal? That's one. I mean, there are three issues, aren't there, that Andy Mitchell raised of particular concern to the construction industry about leaving without a deal. Can you, I mean, do you understand why we were worried about a no deal this January just gone, and now we're worrying about it again?
Well, we've had a year's grace to try and get back to the negotiating table. Now, I've not spoken personally yet to either Boris Johnson or Michel Barnier about exactly what these conversations are. So like everyone else, I rely on the BBC or ITN or my newspapers tell me. And it seems like they are nowhere near agreeing on very much, unless one or other or both are playing a brilliant game of brinksmanship. And at the very, I want to say 11th hour, but we were way past the 11th. I think the 11th hour was about 3 years ago, wasn't it? But the, yeah. You know, the very, very final second of it all, unless they pull some stonking great rabbits out of hats, it does look like we're going to leave with no deal and trading on World Trade Organization, WTO, terms. Now, there are some benefits from that. Certainly, Nigel Farage would explain to you some huge benefits to that. But there are also points which Andy Mitchell points out in his letter to Alok Sharma, that for the construction industry, leave things throwing up in the air. Now, I want to take them in the reverse order to which he raised them in his letter, because I think his first point was the most interesting. So I'll move on to the most interesting point, I think, at the end.
Yeah.
His first point was one that has been well rehearsed, and it's the whole point of the workforce, access to migrant labour. And this has been a hot potato, and it's very much part of the whole debate over Brexit in the first place. There was, of course, a big issue in broad brush terms was the extent of taking back control and Britain being ruled by Brussels and that sort of thing. And another part of it was the population growth, the arrivals on the shore of particularly East European migrant labour coming over. And while for the UK construction industry it was very, very helpful, a lot of people felt uncomfortable with it. The fact that we were unable to have any Britain did not rule its own borders. And again, that goes to the Brussels having greater say than Westminster sort of sense or argument. So Andy Mitchell makes a point that while I'll quote, "We welcome the government's announcement that a number of additional construction trades have now been included in the Tier 2 skilled worker category, such as bricklayers, carpenters and electricians, and the new entrant route is to include those working towards professional qualifications. However, a number of roles are still outside the new system: labourers, dryliners, asbestos removers and some plant operators." And we have a clear need for these. So basically, he says that the Construction Leadership Council, speaking for the entire UK construction industry, he says that the temporary worker route that has been proposed by the government, it needs to be extended from 1 year to 2 years. They've got to be allowed to stay for 2 years on a temporary worker visa.
This tier two skilled work category, Phil, what does it mean? I mean, how many tiers are there as well? Do you know?
No, I'd have to go back to that.
Put you on the spot there.
My understanding of tier two, it's a sort of an educational level. It's at what level you know, it's all to do with NVQ kind of things as to what stage you are in your education. But it, essentially it's saying that the government has given leeway to certain construction trades, not others. And Andy Mitchell wants a clean, across the board, two-year temporary visa. I mean, if you remember, I don't know if we talked about this before, but certainly we've written about it. There was a salary threshold, which was, if you're in London, not particularly 30, high. 000. If you're outside of London, was quite high. I think it's 26,700 or something like that. Off the top of my head. 27,600. Yeah. Which, as I say, is a pretty good salary for many parts of the country, but perhaps not so much in London, where the dependence on migrant labour is the greatest, and I think that shouldn't be too much of an obstacle. But anyway, the whole workforce thing, there's not too much to say that there. It remains an issue, but I don't think people are any longer getting particularly worked up and riled about it, particularly the construction industry laying off the government 10 at the moment.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's true. I suspect that the government would be perfectly prepared to make those minor adjustments to the who's in and who's out of the tier two category. If the industry says that you can't have plasterers in but crane operators out, then I'm sure that the government will probably accept those arguments if they're well made and make the adjustments necessary. So I think he's right to raise the subject, but I don't think it's going to be a problem. I think it'll be resolved quite easily, actually. So that was the access to migrant labour issue. What other issues was he worried about?
Number two issue, second issue, not movement of people, but movement of goods and services, or more particularly goods. Mm. We don't know, under the current no deal scenario, what or how much our construction materials that we import from the European Union are going to cost next year. Hmm. Now, last year, we imported nearly 18 billion, we being Britain, imported nearly, in fact, I'm looking at these figures, I assume it's Britain, it might even be England. The trouble is my job trying to look at what government numbers are is some of these numbers are England and some are Britain because of devolved functions to Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland. But I believe this is a British number. 17.7, let's call it £18 billion worth of construction materials and construction products, materials and components. So we're not talking about machinery, it's mm-hmm. materials and components, was imported. And roughly 60% of that was from the European Union. But that's a good slug of billions of pounds spent on European Union materials. And they might be taxed at a new high rate as of January, 1st of January 2021. If you're pricing a job for next year, you've got no idea what it's going to cost you because you don't know what your materials are going to cost.
No.
This is an extraordinary problem for the construction industry, it seems to me. In the words of Andy Mitchell, currently businesses are unable to adequately predict the prices and costs of materials and goods that originate from the EU after the 1st of January. Without being able to anticipate, their ability to reliably source and cost materials and products when needed will have profound impacts on business planning, site operations, project completion, contractual uncertainty, cash flow, and ultimately, business survival. That sounds and is a nightmare scenario. What I find slightly odd is that what Andy Mitchell is asking for Alok Sharma solution to this is not pull your bloody finger out, Secretary of State, and get this sorted and either make sure there's no new tax or we know what the tax is. He says, therefore, we must ramp up the business information campaigns, informing businesses of the likely border arrangements and actions they should take to prepare for no deal. I think even if there is no deal, we don't know. I mean, I think all the business information campaign would do is listen up at all these businesses. You need to know that we don't know what's going on.
Yeah, you need to start panicking. That's basically what it means.
So I'm not quite sure how a business information campaign can particularly help, except to tell people stop pricing for jobs next year because you don't know what it's going to cost.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, ridiculous. And the third topic that he raised was product standardisation. I thought that was a very interesting one and a far more nuanced issue as well, because, you know, we are, everything at the moment is governed by European standards. All our product certification is all harmonised European standards. And of course, in the past, we've had a very important role to play in formulating these standards. We've been able to not only influence them, but we've been able to propose them and help develop them, and we've been at the forefront. The question is now, do we continue to use European standards, or do we go out on a limb and start to develop our own standards? I mean, I can't imagine that we would do the latter, but there are problems with the former as well, aren't there?
Well, the point that Andy Mitchell makes is that the government's first draft at all of this was to come up with something called UK Conformity Assessed, UKCA, as a replacement for the CE mark, the European Conformity mark. So yeah. UKCA will replace CE, and on withdrawal, on exit day, every UKCA will equal every CE. It'll just be a like for like. It'd be a different badge, but it would mean the same thing.
Right. So existing standards we would simply
transfer.
adopt and call them something else, but they'd be basically harmonised with the rest of Europe.
On day one. There on in,
on day
we
one,
can
yeah.
we can diverge governments from, or industry, well, not industry per se, but being pushed by industries, I guess, but the UK standards could be free to take their own direction, free of Brussels, of the CE marking process. But even if they did that, there's no framework in place for mutual recognition. So if a UK standard decided that I can't even think of an example, but if it wanted to move away from a CE standard at a certain point, or as a tighter standard particularly, would Brussels say, yes, we acknowledge that the UK standard is as good as or tighter than, better than European standards, so anything that UK CA do will go along with that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what Andy Mitchell wants. He says that we need to reach an agreement on mutual recognition of such standards, of UK CA and CE. Without mutual recognition of, for example, testing standards, he says, UK businesses will have to repeatedly test products for different markets, adding substantial costs and delay and damaging competitiveness. Now, the thing is that standards and regulations, in some ways, are the biggest yawn, and they can be a really boring thing to write about because it's all about the detail. But in the broadest sense, they're the most interesting thing because it really, I mean, there's been a lot in the papers that people will have read about chlorinated chicken and food standards and these sort of things.
That's right, yeah.
You know, what do we think of American food standards? Should we be accepting them as good enough for Britain? And I think you talk about food standards, and it's very easy for the lay person in the street or on the Clapham omnibus to get it, you know, yeah, completely understand they want their food to be safe. When you're talking about how we measure the safe lifting capacity of a crane or an excavator, whether it's been, you know, 85% of tipping load or 80% of tipping load, and why that matters, people sort of naturally will glaze over.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But what there's been, my initial thought on all of this was, you know, when we went to vote for the referendum, and I think I wrote something that, based on the extent to which Britain and the rest of Europe are so utterly entwined in standards and regulations, that even if we depart from the European Union, it was unthinkable that we would depart from European norms and standards because, as you rightly say, so many British people and so much of, you know, Britain had been at the forefront of that. I mean, we love a rule in Britain here.
Absolutely.
We're great at writing rules. And we set, you know, Boris Johnson in his time on the cub journalist, junior reporter on the Daily Telegraph years ago, would make up stories about, you know, the Brussels coming up with a new law about how bendy bananas had to be, otherwise you couldn't.
Yes.
And,
you know, he wasn't behind the bendy banana story, was he?
He was behind most of the myths and urban legends that came out. But in fact, an awful lot of the really gricey, you know, dirty details that have come on these European standards have come from working parties, either chaired by or with substantial British involvement, even in product.
Well, that's the irony, isn't it? We talk about, you know, should we accept European standards? They're actually our standards.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We were instrumental in making them. They are ours.
There's an element of British colonialism with the BSI taking over the world. And it's extended not just to Europe, but to ISO. ISO is a similar story. The International Standardisations Organisation. So it seems to me that the solution for BSI, for Britain, is to, if we are pulling out of Europe with no deal and we're not going to be part of the European standards process, which doesn't look like, then I think we have to chuck all our weight into ISO and let ISO, which is already moving in the direction of Europe. I mean, European regs and ISO regs are, in many ways, I mean, certainly in a lot of the considered construction and construction machinery have become a greater level of harmony. The way forward is to push ISO as I don't say all powerful, anybody to be powerful, but all influential, that that we don't talk about CE marking anymore. It becomes, you know, ISO marking. And I voted Remain because my view of Europe is not that it's I want to be ruled by another country, is that I'm not a fan of national borders. I like internationalisation. I recognise that globalisation and has its problems with eroding national cultures, and the Coca-Colaization, as it's called, of the world is, and I do struggle with how you reconcile bringing down national borders and boundaries and barriers and walls without letting, you know, Coca-Cola and Facebook and Levi jeans
take over the world
and every high street
taking
over. I realise I'm going off on one here. You got me on one of my pet subjects. David, what do you think of standardisation?
That's all right. I'm following. I'm with you.
What do you think of standardisation? Why do we need it? Why can't we be different?
Well, I would say look at your three-pin socket in the wall, the nearest one to you. Who else uses that particular socket and that particular plug? Nobody else in the world. We've got the biggest, clunkiest, stupid electrical connections of anyone in the whole world. You go to America and you go to anywhere in Europe, they've got these nifty little two-pin round pin plugs which fit in a socket, and yet we've got to carry around an adapter in order to use our various different pieces of equipment. I mean, standardization, I'm amazed that standardization appears not to extend to electrical sockets, but I think that's a perfectly good example of why it's important to standardise. Another thing is, I mean, you can't see my desk. At least you can't see the business end of it. But it's a mass of wires. And that's because every single that the lead going into my phone is entirely different to the one coming out of my phone, which my headphones are attached to. I've got a USB 3 going into my phone. It's coming out of a USB 1 which is stuck into via an adapter into the wall. I've got a 3mm round pin. Anyway, really, all these things should be standardised. You know, it's a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned. It makes life easy if we're all singing from the same hymn sheet, to use as, you know, the old saying. But yeah, why not? We can't really operate without standards.
You sound very British. Except no doubt you'll be equally British and defend the right to sell pints of beer.
See, I don't really mind. It doesn't bother me, actually.
I think there's a lot of the myths and legends of gallons of petrol and pints of beer and pounds or kilograms of apples is...
or gills of whiskey.
Is all slightly a red herring. I think any retailer should be allowed to sell you any quantity of whatever that they wish to sell. And I believe that they are. The issue is not that your Johnny Greengrocer can't sell you a pound of apples. It's that when he weighs out a pound of apples, his scales have got to be verified and compliant with the fact that when they say it's a kilogram or a pound or whatever, it really is a kilogram. We have to have an international standard for what is a kilogram. We don't have an international standard for what is a ton. We've got a long ton and a short ton, and one of them is more than a metric ton, and one is less than a metric ton. So it makes much more sense to kick your long and short tons into touch and just have an international metric ton and standardise on it. So that when someone sells you a ton of apples, you know how many apples you've got and not whether you've got less than a ton or more than a ton. Yes. Similar with kilos. So all these people who complain about the grocer not being allowed to sell you a pound of apples, no, so if he sells you a ton of apples, you're likely to get ripped off.
Well, I wonder if you can still buy a quarter of bullseyes. Because that's what I always used to ask for. I think a quarter of bullseyes now would be what? 100 grams?
100 quid,
something
probably.
Like right, shall we move on? What's next on the agenda? Let me think.
Well, Brexit's long-running saga, but an even longer-running saga is HS2.
Good gracious
and
me, yeah.
Equally divisive, I would wager.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure it is.
And I think we'll find HS2 featuring in the newspapers of the construction trade press on a weekly basis for the next 20 years. It'll see us out, I'm quite sure.
Yeah.
Last week's and this week's, the past couple of stories we've done on this, and both of them are quite nice stories that we've covered. One is that the HS2 Limited, the company, the government company behind the project, have endorsed the use of project bank accounts on the project on HS2. So the main contractors on phase one, the payments to their supply chain, if HS2 has said that they back project bank accounts, I don't think they've said that they must be used, which is a different thing.
No, I don't think they have.
But it sounds like they're probably going to be used. Yeah. And this has been welcomed by the subcontractors and the supply chain. What do you know about project bank accounts, Dave? This is something you've written about, I think.
I have. I mean, I can't speak with much authority about project bank accounts. I mean, the idea, of course, is...
It goes back to Latham, your pet project of Latham.
Oh, yeah, well... It was, yes, exactly. It was one of his ideas. Well, it certainly is an idea that he backed. I mean, obviously, that everybody knows, I'm sure, in the supply chain that payment is an issue. And on big infrastructure projects, it's of particular concern because you've got a huge supply chain. And it's the question of pay when paid, retentions, and eventual non-payment. Because, of course, in the worst cases, a main contractor will withhold payment or retention from a supplier until basically that supplier goes under due to...
having not been paid.
Exactly. Project bank accounts...
Or in the case of Carillion, if the main contractor itself goes under and people get left unpaid.
Yes, that's true. Yes, yes, precisely. And so obviously, specialist subcontractors and material suppliers, not so much material suppliers, specialist subcontractors have for many, many years been banging a drum saying we need to find a more equitable arrangement for making sure that the money trickles down the supply chain, that people get paid on time. And, you know, people do get paid in the end, which is, as we've just said, often doesn't happen. And project bank accounts is really the big idea at the moment to tackle this. It's a sort of an escrow arrangement, whereby the money from the client paid to the main contractor and due to the supply chain. So supposing you've got a piling contractor or an electrical contractor, they've done their bit, and they're waiting to be paid. The main contractor is saying, well, hang on a second, we're going to make sure that what you've done is fit for purpose, and so there's all the snagging and all the rest of it. We'll pay you a bit up front, and then you get paid the rest in the end. And it doesn't happen. Well, project bank accounts, of course, the project bank account is there to actually hold the money in trust, effectively, so that the main contractor doesn't nick it and use it for something else, which is also common practice.
So this is all good news.
Yeah, it's good news. And people like the SEC group, the Specialist Engineering Council, have welcomed this. It's what they've been asking for a long time. And of course, when a major infrastructure project like HS2 gives the idea the seal of approval, then that sends a message to the rest of the industry. So it's a very significant step in the right direction, I think. And they've already trialled it, haven't they, on a couple of enabling works contracts, I believe, and presumably it's worked. So they want to roll it out onto other contracts.
Good stuff. Now, the second HS2 story we ran the past few days, very, very different, an architectural one, really. They released some computer-generated images, some photos of barns. And they look quite pretty in these. I mean, you always have to take a pinch of salt these computer-generated images and artist's impressions that you get sent of how beautiful buildings are going to look. And then when the real thing is built, you kind of go, oh, that doesn't look like the picture that you showed me 3 years ago. But these barns look lovely. And they're going to put up these barns in the Chilterns area of outstanding natural beauty. And they're specifically the Chalfont St. Peter vent shaft for where they access the tunnel they're digging under the Chilterns. These barns are going to camouflage the opening of where you access the tunnel from ground level, all to blend in with the countryside with a pre-weathered, I think that probably means the same as weathered, but they said pre-weathered.
It's like when you pre-order something.
Yeah, and pre-book. Apparently you're going to have to pre-book now. It's not enough just to book, you've got to pre-book.
Oh, really? Okay.
So this is weathered, and then it's pre-weathered. Or maybe it's pre-weathered and then weathered. I'm not sure what happens first.
Yeah.
So it's a pre-weathered grey zinc roof and copper-coloured doors, I think it is. Or if you look at the pictures, they've been widely published in newspapers and websites, but you can certainly see them Construction Index. .co.uk. They look rather jolly, and so they should when they've got Grimshaw as the architect involved, because they don't come cheap. And if Grimshaw does you a barn, you expect it to look like not just any old barn, I guess. You want it to be a lovely
barn.
Well,
this is the point, and I think that this is a mistake because people want it to look like any old barn. Surely that's the idea. The idea is that it's incognito. It looks like part of the local architecture. It's a bit of agricultural. It's an agricultural building, not an architect designed statement.
Well, this isn't what you wanted to blend in. If you look at the pictures, this isn't an architectural design statement. It's just a very nice barn. I mean, this is the Chilterns we're talking about here, David, not Somerset or Kent. I mean,
okay.
they'll have nice barns, not things held up with barbed wire and corrugated iron. This is proper.
Okay.
Proper faux countryside.
Yes. All right, then. Home counties, agricultural buildings.
Exactly.
Okay.
Which is interesting because there was an interview with Mark Thurston in the Sunday Times business section this weekend. If you want to dig that out, Sunday the 26th of July, page 8 of the business section of the Sunday Times, where he was insisting that the whole project had not been gold-plated. Clearly, it's just been copper-plated and zinc-plated. But there have been criticisms that tunnelling under the Chilterns and all these sort of things have added huge amounts of cost on the project, which didn't really need to be added if we were
Mark
French
Thurston, by the way, Mark Thurston being the chief executive of HS2 Limited.
Yes, I beg your pardon.
The man in charge of it.
And I hadn't realised until I saw the Sunday Times large half-page photo they got of him quite how much he looks like Les Dennis.
He does, doesn't he?
But
I'm not sure he's
broadly speaking,
and that's saying something.
An interesting read. What did you make of it?
I found it a very entertaining read as well. The bit I liked, and I know it's a bit that you liked as well, was when the journalist interviewing him asked him about his management style and said, isn't it a little bit cheesy? Thurston replied, I'll never forgive you if you put that in print, which of course he's done. Without turning a hair, you know, he's reported it faithfully. I mean, Mark Thurston's a man, he's clearly a bit of a character. He's a South London lad who, according to the Sunday Times, didn't go to university. But if you look him up on Wikipedia, he's got an MSc from Loughborough University. I don't think he did a bachelor's degree. He's a postgraduate job. He's got a very good track record, but even he seems rather surprised that he's found himself in such an exalted position now, doesn't it, don't you think?
Well, it's a bit of a poison chalice to take on, I think.
Well, true, true. I mean, he's worked... What other projects has he worked on? He worked on Crossrail... Crossrail Ties?
It seems like 2012 is where he made his name. The Olympic project.
He was in charge
of roads and bridges with CH2M Hill.
The CH2M Hill, yeah, which should be called Cheetham Hill.
Exactly that. Or Halco if you're old school.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So, he's got a pretty good CV, but he's also got a very good remuneration package, hasn't he? He's earning $660,000 a year, is it?
It says he's the highest paid public servant. I think John Armit used to hold that title. So I quite like the fact that highest paid public servants are
always in the construction sector.
Major projects. I mean, I think Simon Stevens, who runs the NHS, might be thinking, hang on a minute, isn't my job a bit bigger, folks?
Well, quite, yes. I mean, everybody loves his organisation. So quite interesting. HS2, as you rightly pointed out at the beginning of the discussion, is rather like, well, just like Brexit, very divisive. Those who are dead against it and those who are desperately in favour of it. And you and I are on either side of this divide, aren't we? Because you're a big proponent, or at least you approve of HS2, and I don't.
Well, I in general get excited by big projects, which is not a reason to do them. I realise that. That's not an argument for it. But I'm also, you know, I'm a Bradford boy. I grew up in the Leeds Bradford area, and I've spent enough time travelling up and down north south of the country to like the idea of better connections, you know, between north and south of England. So, yeah, I find when talk of 100 billion comes up, I have to sort of shut my eyes and we've learnt in the past few months anyway, Rishi's told us it's only play money, we can borrow it, and you know, we found the magic money tree.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
We don't really need to worry about the money anymore.
Well, actually, that's another You've touched on something else which Mark Thurston mentions in this article, which is he basically says, well, of course these big infrastructure jobs go over budget. I mean, you know, what was the original estimate for HS2? It was about 50 or 60 billion, wasn't
it? Oh, it's less than that,
well,
I think.
Well, it's now...
Was it? At the beginning, we were only talking about, you know, the London to Birmingham bit. The 100
yeah,
billion,
that's true.
Or whatever above that you want to get at, is taking it up to Leeds and Manchester as well. But the London to Birmingham bit, do you know what? I can't remember, but I think it was under 20 billion. But that was before they were talking about.
Well, that's just phase one, yeah.
And things like that.
Well, it's now something in excess of 100 billion.
But it's a different project.
It's
a different project, though, now.
Yes, that's true. Thurston's right. These big infrastructure projects do always go over budget because somebody has an idea and they'll say, yes, let's do it. Somebody does a few calculations and say it'll cost you this much. But of course, that's in, I don't know, 1990 money, and it's not going to be built until 2021 or something like that. And so it is a little bit like sticking a wet finger in the air and seeing, oh, you know, it's going to cost so-and-so. But it's just this sort of flippant way that he sort of dismisses it in this article as saying, yeah, of course it goes over budget. That's nothing to worry about. Nothing to worry about. I think a lot of people, especially taxpayers who will be footing the bill, would perhaps beg to disagree with him on that.
Well, there's an age-old rule of government that if you want to get a project through ministers, you make up a number that you think you can get past him or her. And then after that, you start sort of, you know, creeping it up towards a real number. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if the person who came up with the original number knew that was way off mark, but just figured it was a politically acceptable number and then take it from there and move forward. But
I imagine that's standard practice.
But also there's an awful lot of horse trading that goes on in the political sense in these projects. We mentioned the tunnel under the Chilterns.
Yeah.
That was a, we'll support the project if you keep it outside of my constituency kind of thing. And not all of those measures, all those environmental amelioration measures, can be built in, can be afforded. And at some stage, some people are losing their houses, are losing their farms, are losing their properties.
Yeah.
Some woodlands are being chopped down. And all of this is a bad thing. So you weigh up the greater good with the greater bad, and you make a judgment call. And that's why we elect politicians to make these judgment calls in Parliament and so on. What has not been very well reported, it was just starting to be reported, actually, is the opposition to the... I don't mean the people who are opposed to it.
The environmental opposition.
Active opposition.
Yes.
Taking root. In the same issue of the Sunday Times this last weekend, they sent their star feature writer to spend a night up a tree in a treehouse with some of the protesters in a wood in Buckinghamshire. And the security gangs with their chainsaws are going and chopping down trees. And mostly, but not exclusively, young people have got themselves padlocked up trees to protect the trees. We've been here before.
Yeah, well, this
the swampy at Twyford
Down.
This
is like going back in time, isn't
it? Yes.
Anybody who remembers the Twyford Down protests... back in the 90s when they were extending the... Was it the M3? Yes, it must have been.
Yes, the M3 through Winchester, around Winchester,
that's
I should
right.
say.
Yeah, and we had Swampy, the protester, who became a media star for a while.
And the Newbury bypass shortly afterwards. Is that the A34,
that's right.
Is it? The Newbury bypass was another one of these. Very contentious. And a lot of people may have thought these bloody anarchists, you know, these things have been voted for and they're just acting against the democratic process. But they actually succeeded, these people, in derailing the road building programme for a generation. It really made governments think again. They had enormous impact. They didn't stop the projects they were working on, but they had a profound impact on public consciousness and generated a lot of public support.
And there was a lot of media coverage.
And there was a lot of media coverage.
That was one of the interesting things. There was a lot of media coverage at the time.
Whereas these guys on HS2 are not getting that sort of media coverage, which is partly, I think, a function of the way the media works these days. Too many of us sit at our desk and wait for things to ping into our inbox and we work from there. And we don't get out and about and... it's been pretty hard the past few months, to be honest, to get out and about anyway. But we don't get out and about. We don't have the staff to walk the beat, as in Bobby parlance, and meet people and talk to people and find out what's going on the street. Similarly, these activist groups, they've have social media or electronic communications, their own sort of channels to communicate with each other and network, so they don't necessarily need the mainstream media. They'll complain about the mainstream media only publishing HS2's press releases and not reporting on their plight. I think they're getting more reports now that unfortunately one or two of them have been ended up in hospital for being basically chopped, felled down from trees and chopped off their zip
wires. That's right.
It is starting to get reported. And as I say, though I am for HS2, I do have sympathy for... God, that sounds patronising. I do have admiration for... It doesn't sound much better. But people are prepared to you know, put themselves on the line and lie down in front of the bulldozers like Boris Johnson hasn't. Even though he said he would in the context of Heathrow.
Oh, he said he promised it. I was still waiting for that. But I mean, Rosie Kinchin's piece in the Sunday Times was interesting because I thought she did a very good sort of warts and all type report. She was obviously sympathetic to a degree with the protesters. She obviously, rather like you and I, admired their commitment. And there's no doubt that, you know, if somebody who spends days on end in a tree is not doing it for fun. I mean, it might be fun for the first 12 hours, but not after a week or so. And you know, these people are obviously very sincere. Their public image, I suppose, is probably their weak, you know, their Achilles heel, because Middle England, whose countryside they're trying to save, probably wouldn't approve of them, you know, sort of with white dreadlocks.
No, I don't know. I think there's the Greenham Common thing going on here. I think there's and not just here, at all these environmental campaigns that go back to Twyford Down and Newbury, there might be it spans the people who think it's a bit of fun and somewhere to live out in the wild and smoke some spliff for a while. But all the way through to the educated, young professional, committed person who's doing it for not just for giggles, but because they really, really mean it. And I think that's the dominant thing there. And the children of, the offspring of the Middle Englander people. And I think a lot of parents are probably driving their you know, 20-something-year-old or teenage offspring to these campsites which are springing up all over the place and giving them, you know, thermos flasks and packed lunches and probably taking secret
and bottles of Jack Daniels, according to Rosie Kinchin.
Well, I'm not suggesting that the youngsters are doing that, but I don't know. I think it would be wrong to write them, you know, to write them all off as hippies and anarchists. As a hippie and anarchist,
I'm certainly not doing that. What I'm saying is that their image is that, you know, and if you look at the pictures, you know, they are sitting around a campfire, strumming guitars, banging bongos, and as I said, with their hair in dreadlocks.
But I think the problem is after you've spent a week up a tree, you're not going to look as clean and well groomed as you and I, David.
That's true. That's true. And I think we really ought to actually address the main issue, which is why they are protesting in the first place. And this is where I am in full support of them, really. And that's the environmental damage that HS2 is doing or threatens to do. I can't remember, something like 700 wildlife sites, 33 sites of special scientific interest, over 100 ancient woodlands. They're all going to disappear. At least one chalk stream will dry up because the aquifer will be drained by the tunnelling equipment, according to one environmental campaigner. And I personally think that's deplorable. I don't know if you know much about chalk streams, if you're a trout fisherman at all, Phil, but the England has 80% of the world's chalk streams. Now, I didn't realise this. I know it's a quintessentially English landscape, you know, the water meadows with the gin-clear water trickling through them and the gravel bottom and the brown trout and all the rest of it. You know, nearly all the world's chalk streams are in this country, and I think that to destroy even one is an unforgivable sin. I really do. I think that that is exactly the sort of natural resource that we should be preserving. And if it means sending HS2 in a completely different direction, then so be it. But they'd never do that. I think that to build a railway whose business case I think is still unproven, and to irrevocably destroy a natural resource like a chalk stream, I cannot see an argument for it.
I am the wrong person and completely ill-equipped to argue your point on chalk streams. Although what I do know about chalk streams is that one of the leading campaigners for them is a fellow fisherman like yourself, one of my great heroes, Fergal Sharkey. And I don't know if that name means much to you, but Fergal Sharkey, the former lead singer of the Undertones, is a major leader in the campaign to save chalk streams. I believe he lives somewhere in the sort of Hertfordshire, northern home counties area where the these chalk streams are under threat and being impacted upon.
Right,
you talk about. So maybe you can get him onto our podcast next week and tell us more about this issue and what we should be doing.
I'd love to. We'd end up talking about teenage kicks, wouldn't we? Instead of talking about HS2.
Well, I'm sure we can cover a wide amount of ground with him.
Well, I think that we could argue quite justifiably, I suppose, that it's not for us to focus on the environmental protesters, but they're part of the story. So, and we haven't covered them today.
No, it's a big part. I think they will have, just as they impacted on the roads programme, it will impact on construction. There'll be all sorts of things. If this accelerates in the way that it looks like it's going to accelerate, and we have pages of dead protesters being hacked down from trees, and or broken arms and broken limbs, and attractive looking young things with blood coming from their face, and parents saying it's outrageous what these bullies in hard hats and with chainsaws have done to my poor little children, it will make a big difference to how the construction industry goes about things. It'll have to come up with new ways of sensitively clearing sites. I don't mean just clearing people from sites. I mean, there'll have to be new procedures drawn up. There will be papers from the Construction Leadership Council of how to chop down a tree without hurting it. Things will change.
So, Phil, have we reached a conclusion to this week's discussion?
I think we have. I feel like we could have had this conversation a very, very long time ago with Brexit and HS2.
Yeah, we probably should have done.
We have to be talking about... There's something in the newspaper this morning about... space exploration, a British satellite launching or space investment or something. So maybe we'll be back to, and he said, Roy Rogers, Buck Rogers in the future. Next week, not Roy Rogers, he's a cowboy, he's the past.
Yes, that's true. Well, plenty of those in the construction industry as well. I didn't say that.
Anyway, good news, folks. If you are a regular listener, we'll be having more for you to listen to. We're going back to our weekly cycle next week and move there on forward. This reconstruction podcast will be back on a weekly basis. So we'll David and I have to try and think of some new things to chat about, but there's always a lot to talk about in the construction industry. Podcast at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing. We're currently offering a massive 80% discount on subscriptions to the Construction Index magazine. Order yours online today for only £1 per issue. Visit theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine to subscribe.